Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. We first look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. From an article in the Huffington Post by Ryan McCarthy, foreclosure mill employees got gifts for altering documents, witness says. At a large Florida foreclosure mill, a manager signed up to 1,000 documents a day without reading them, and employees were given gifts to speed up foreclosure paperwork, according to depositions released today by the Florida Attorney General's office. The news, also reported by Tampa Online, comes as Bank of America, the nation's largest bank by assets, announced that it would resume more than 100,000 foreclosures in 23 states after an internal investigation of its practices. Florida authorities are investigating the law offices of David J. Stern over how it handled foreclosure paperwork. As the AP notes, Cheryl Salmons, an office manager at the law office of David Stern, would sign 500 files in the morning and another 500 files in the afternoon without reviewing them and with no witnesses, according to Kelly Scott, a former assistant at the firm. The perks for good performance were considerable, according to Scott's statement. Tampa Online notes, office employees were lavished with gifts. As a perk of Salmon's job, Stern's office would routinely pay her personal mortgage, a car payment, her electric bills, and her cell phone bill, according to Scott, who told investigators Stern also bought Salmons a new BMW Sport utility vehicle every year and gave her and other employees jewelry. Additionally, Stern purchased employee David Varkas a house, a car, and a cell phone, Scott claims in her statement. According to Kelly Scott's statement, Cheryl's marathon document signing sessions took place in an office conference room and would leave her wearied. From Scott's deposition, they would be stacked amongst each other side by side, and Cheryl would come twice a day in the morning and mid-afternoon around 2 or 3 o'clock, and she would sign all of them, every single one of them. Cheryl would give certain paralegals rights to sign her name, because most of the time she was very tired and exhausted from signing her name numerous times per day. You had to understand it was more than 500 files that she signing morning and afternoon. David Stern had an especially close relationship with the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, Scott said in her statement. The lenders were considered his babies. Employees would change codes to hide files when their representatives visited the office. And that was from the Huffington Post. And from The Raw Story by Daniel Tenser, CNBC predicts Congress will retroactively legalize foreclosure fraud. Congress will pass a bill to forgive banks the potentially criminal errors made in foreclosure proceedings, a senior CNBC editor predicts. In a recent blog column, John Carney argues that lawmakers in D.C. won't allow the country's largest issuers of mortgages to suffer financial losses following revelations of numerous mishandled foreclosure proceedings, especially when bailing them out this time won't cost taxpayers a dime. Here is what is going to happen. Congress will pass a law called something like the Financial Modernization and Stability Act of 2010 that will retroactively grant mortgage pools the rights in the underlying mortgages that people are worried about. All of the messed up paperwork, lost notes, unassigned security interests will be forgiven by a legislative act. The foreclosure crisis is not driven by economics. It is driven by legal rights. And there's simply zero probability that the politicians in Washington are going to let Bank of America or Citigroup or J.P. Morgan Chase fail because of a legal issue. Carney predicts that the lame duck session of Congress following this November's elections will pass the law. Every member of Congress who has been voted out of office will cast a vote for the bill, and the president will sign it. Major bank stocks have suffered losses this week as an increasingly large body of evidence has emerged suggesting that banks and their contractors may not have done the most basic vetting of foreclosure paperwork, instead using robo-signers to rubber stamp whatever foreclosure applications were brought forward. The Associated Press reported last week, in an effort to rush through thousands of home foreclosures since 2007, financial institutions and their mortgage servicing departments hired hairstylists, Walmart floor workers, and people who had worked on assembly lines and installed them in foreclosure expert jobs with no formal training, a Florida lawyer says. In the depositions released last week, many of those workers testified that they barely knew what a mortgage was. Some couldn't define the word affidavit. Others didn't know what a complaint was or even what was meant by personal property. Most troubling, several said they knew they were lying when they signed the foreclosure affidavits and that they agreed with the defense lawyer's accusations about document fraud. The result has been a steady stream of allegations of wrongly foreclosed homes. In one notorious incident last month, a Florida man who had bought his home for cash and carried no mortgage was stunned to find his home in foreclosure. In another incident, a woman who was behind on payments, but not in foreclosure, called 911 when she heard what she thought was a burglar, but was, in fact, a J.P. Morgan contractor coming to change the locks on her home. In many instances, those shortcuts and mistakes may have violated laws. Attorney generals in all 50 states have now launched probes into foreclosure practices. Bank of America has halted foreclosure proceedings in all states, while Ally Financial, formerly GMAC, J.P. Morgan, and others have announced partial suspensions. Carney admits that, with outrage growing over unscrupulous foreclosure practices, a second bailout of banks would be politically unpopular. Will the public be outraged? He writes. Probably. Financial bloggers will scream from the high heavens against another bailout of the banksters. Congress may try to create some cost for banks in exchange for the forgiveness, perhaps requiring more mortgage modifications, but the much-feared foreclosure apocalypse will be laid to rest. And that was by Daniel Tenser, writing about the CNBC prediction that Congress will retroactively legalize foreclosure fraud. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now, last week, we were rehashing a lot of The Two Income Trap by Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tiagi, through an article that was written in Harvard Magazine called The Middle Class on the Precipice: Rising Financial Risks for American Families. So I'd like to continue where I left off, going to the point where the rules have changed. Again, according to the professor, the 1-2 punch of income vulnerability and rising costs has weakened the middle class, at the same time that the revision of the rules of financing delivers a death blow to millions of families each year. Since the early 1980s, the credit industry has rewritten the rules of lending to families. Congress has turned the industry loose to charge whatever it can get and to bury tricks and traps throughout credit agreements. Credit card contracts that were less than a page long in the early 1980s now number 30 or more pages of small print legalese. In the details, credit card companies lend money at one rate, but retain the right to change the interest rate whenever it suits them. They can even raise the rate after the money has been borrowed, a practice once considered too shady even for a back-alley loan shark. When they think they have been cheated, customers can be forced into arbitration in locations thousands of miles from home. Some companies claim that they can repossess anything a customer buys with a credit card. Credit card issuers are not alone in their boldness. Home mortgage lenders are writing mortgages that are so one-sided that some of their products are known as loan to own because it is the mortgage company, not the buyer, who will end up with the house. Payday lenders are ringing military bases and setting up shop in working-class neighborhoods, offering instant cash that can eventually cost the customer more than 1,000% interest. Now, I note that some of these practices have been addressed by law for the military and, to some degree, the credit industry in the last year. However, the lenders quickly find loopholes in the law or create creative methods not covered by the law to maintain their practices. But back to Professor Warren, for those who can stay out of debt, the rules of lending may not matter, but the economic pressures on the middle class are causing more families to turn to credit just to make ends meet. When something goes wrong, the only place to turn is credit cards and mortgage refinancing. At that moment, the change in lending rules matter very much indeed. The family that might manage $2,000 of debt at 9% discovers that it cannot stay afloat when interest rates skyrocket to 29%. And the family that refinanced the home mortgage to pay off other debts suddenly faces escalating monthly payments and may find itself staring at foreclosure. Job losses and medical debts can put any family in a hole, but a credit industry that has rewritten the rules can keep the family from ever climbing back. So what are the politics of living on the edge? Every day, middle-class families carry higher risks that a job loss or a medical problem will push them over the edge. Although plenty of families make it, a growing number who worked just as hard and followed the rules just as carefully find themselves in a financial nightmare. The security of middle-class life has disappeared. The new reality is millions of families whose grip on the good life can be shaken loose in an instant. Professor Warren continues, although my work on bankruptcy and credit has focused on the specifics of families' household finances, I cannot help but think that their changed circumstances during the past generation have larger echoes for public policy. During the same period, families have been asked to absorb much more risk in their retirement income. In 1985, there were 112,200 defined benefit pension plans with employers and employer groups around the country. Today, their number has shrunk to 29,700 such plans, and those are melting away fast. Steelworkers, airline employees, and now those in the auto industry are joining millions of families who must worry about interest rates, stock market volatility, and the harsh reality that they may outlive their retirement money. During the end of the Bush administration, President Bush campaigned to move Social Security to a savings account model, with retirees trading much of or all of their guaranteed payments for payments contingent on investment returns. For younger families, the picture is not any better. Both the absolute cost of health care and the share of it borne by families have risen, and newly fashionable health savings plans are spreading from legislative halls to Walmart workers with much higher deductibles and a large new dose of investment risk for families' future health care. Even demographics are working against the middle-class family, as the odds of having a frail elderly parent and all the attendant need for physical and financial assistance have jumped eightfold in just one generation. From the middle-class family perspective, much of this, understandably, looks far less like an opportunity to exercise more financial responsibility, and a good deal more like a frightening acceleration of the wholesale shift of financial risk onto their already overburdened shoulders. The financial fallout has begun, and the political fallout may not be far behind. And so that was a portion of an article in the Harvard Magazine by Elizabeth Warren, taken from her paper, Rewriting the Rules, Families, Money, and Risk, which was a paper written for the nonprofit Social Science Research Council. Now I'd like to jump over to articles written in the Boston Globe called Debtor's Hell. And I'll start with part one, Preying on Red Ink America, No Mercy for Consumers. Firms' tactics are one mark of a system that penalizes those who owe. It was just before 6 a.m. on a Saturday in the fall of 2002 when Marie-Colette Dimanche woke to a loud rapping at the door of her Matt Tappan duplex. With her night robe on and her two daughters still sleeping, she rushed down the stairs and peered out the window. Outside, a tow truck blocked her driveway and her 1996 Chevy Blazer. A man and a woman with a court order told the single mother they had come to take her car for a non-payment of an old credit card debt. With interest and legal fees, the bill totaled more than $2,000, and it came from a company called Commonwealth Receivables. They gave her a choice, pay the money now in cash or hand over the keys. Dimanche had never heard of Commonwealth and believed the debt had been paid by a social services agency. I just said, you guys must be insane, she recalled. She had reason to be stunned. The debt was at least 5 years old, and she'd never got notice of the lawsuit against her. When Commonwealth, a local debt collector, went after Dimanche, the address it supplied the court was one she hadn't lived in for more than a decade. But Dimanche didn't have the paperwork to prove the debt had been paid off, and she didn't have $2,000. What could I do? She said. I gave them the key. Dimanche is one of thousands of Massachusetts residents who have had their cars seized and lives upended by a pair of debt collection companies, Commonwealth Receivables, Inc. of Watertown and Norfolk Financial Corp. of West Roxbury, run by two brothers, one of whom was disbarred this year for his business practices. Norfolk and Commonwealth became two of the state's most litigious and aggressive collectors, according to a Globe Spotlight team investigation. And I'll get back to this in a moment. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to debtor's hell. In America's debt-saturated culture, Chad E. and Daniel W. Goldstone are among the clear winners. They are perhaps the most active local players in a nationwide debt collection industry that has exploded in size and profits, inundating court systems in Massachusetts and across the country, with collection lawsuits seeking tens of billions of dollars in debts that are often purchased for collection by the Goldstones and hundreds of other firms for just pennies on the dollar. The success of such firms is a measure of how dramatically the world of consumer debt in America has changed. It isn't just that consumers lean too heavily on credit cards to get by. It is that, almost unnoticed by policymakers, many millions of Americans have slid or been pushed into a debtor's hell where bank accounts are drained, wages are attached, property confiscated, and threats of jail are an everyday occurrence. A fate once reserved for the worst deadbeats has become commonplace. The losers are the friends, neighbors, or relatives of just about everyone, people who generally owe the money collectors are after but don't deserve what comes next. People such as Ana Rios, a 40-year-old Maynard woman whose car was hooked near midnight even though her debts had been erased through bankruptcy. Or Thomas Jessamy, a 45-year-old Saugus man who spent 6 months struggling to get his car back after it was seized for an old credit card bill. An estimated one of every 11 consumers has at least one credit card that is more than 90 days past due, according to nationwide data provided to The Globe by the credit reporting agency Experian. Many are already being pursued by debt collectors, or someday will be, and it is a vast army coming after them. In the last decade, the ranks of debt collectors have doubled to 162,000, making debt collection among the fastest growing sectors of the financial services industry. In Massachusetts, a spotlight review of records in all 70 district courts and interviews with court officials and collection attorneys found that professional collectors filed an estimated 575,000 lawsuits between 2000 and 2005, about one lawsuit for every 11 Bay State residents. The vast bulk of those were filed as small claims actions in the district courts, where debt collectors always have lawyers and the debtors almost never do. At nearly every stage, the Globe found that the debt collection system in the state is stacked against the average consumer. Many small claims courts have effectively become accomplices of collection firms, routinely giving them the upper hand in court cases while casually disregarding the rights and dignity of ordinary citizens. Collectors almost always win the lawsuits they file without being asked for evidence that the debts they are chasing are actually owed. Like Demange, debtors frequently receive no notice of the lawsuits against them because debt collectors provide courts with outdated addresses for the people they are suing. The disabled, the elderly, and the working poor are often talked into repaying their debts from their monthly government checks, which by law are protected from legal judgments, and an obscure posse of law enforcement agents, constables, and deputy sheriffs operate freely as the blunt instrument of collection firms, with neither their steep fees nor their sometimes heavy-handed tactics regulated. It is, in short, a system made safe and very profitable for Massachusetts collectors, such as Commonwealth and Norfolk, and for others like them across the country. The creditors are all repeat players. They know exactly how the game works, said Elizabeth Warren. We're watching a fight between two players, one a skilled repeat gladiator, and one who's thrown into the ring for the first time and gets clubbed over the head before they even get a sense of what the rules are. Commonwealth and Norfolk have built a reputation for operating at the edge of this increasingly aggressive and methodical trade. It is a business with many reputable players, firms that collect money zealously but rarely cross the line of fairness. And then there are those that seem to live by another set of rules. Commonwealth, owned by 41-year-old Chad Gladstone, and Norfolk, owned by his brother Daniel, who is 44, are among the most active users of the state's small claims courts, where lawsuits are limited to $2,000 or less. Together, the two firms have filed about 12,000 lawsuits in each of the last 4 years, in all but two of the state's 70 local courts, according to records examined by The Globe. That is more than 10% of the state's small claims caseload. As For car seizures, a tactic many collectors consider harsh and unseemly, the Gladstones have made it an everyday practice. "The way he handles cases offends us," said Richard S. Daniels, Jr., the owner of a large Boston collection law firm, speaking of Daniel Gladstone. "His practice is abusive." Seizing cars to collect old debts is lawful in Massachusetts, but time and again, those working on the Gladstones' behalf have turned it into an excruciating ordeal for consumers, making dark of the night collection visits and holding car hostages until debtors can scrounge up the cash to pay down a past due amount. Almost always, debtors who have their cars towed wind up paying for more than their original debt. Part of that is interest, of course, but is also the result of hefty fees charged by the people who work on the Gladstones' behalf, the kind of people Demange found knocking at her door just after dawn, locally appointed constables, deputy sheriffs, and tow lot operators. And in cases where debtors are unable or unwilling to pay the debt, plus the high seizure, towing, and storage fees, their cars are auctioned off for a fraction of their market value, or they are junked, leaving the debtors without transportation and still liable for most or all of the debt. The sight of a tow truck at the door is unsettling enough, but for some debtors chased by Norfolk and Commonwealth, it is literally the first they have heard that they are being sued. In several lawsuits examined by the Globe reporters, Demanches among them, the two companies provided incorrect addresses to the courts, with the result that the judgments were issued without the knowledge of the debtors. But finding the right address is seldom a problem for the constables and sheriffs Norfolk and Commonwealth hire to seize the debtors' cars. As Demanche said in a handwritten plea to the court days after her car was taken, "I, Marie Demanche, was never notified of any court hearing, and a judgment was passed without my presence to defend myself." But no court motion could fully describe what Demanche had lost. The day she handed over her keys, her only means to get to work and her children to school, was the last day she would ever see her car. And how many others sued by the Goldstones have had their car seized? The court, which authorized the action, don't keep records that would allow such a tally. But other official documents strongly suggest that the two firms have been seizing thousands of cars a year. For example, in affidavits filed in a lawsuit involving Norfolk Financial, Chad Goldstone, an employee of Daniel Goldstone, estimated that 4 years ago, a single constable company was hooking about 1,200 cars a year for the two brothers. In the two-year period of 2004 and 2005, deputy sheriffs in four counties, Plymouth, Norfolk, Bristol, and Worcester, seized 1,073 cars just for Norfolk Financial, a Globe review found. That volume makes the two firms the dominant players in car seizures statewide. Both brothers and their lawyer, John J. O'Connor of the Boston law firm of Peabody and Arnold, defend the propriety of their business practices. "We work hard to handle all matters with courtesy and fairness and in compliance with all legal requirements," they said in a written statement. The Boston Globe interviewed Chad Goldstone, and Daniel Goldstone did agree to sit-down interview, but then canceled it. The Goldstones cited state privacy laws and federal statutes that protect debtors as justification for declining to answer most of the questions about their businesses or to discuss lawsuits that they filed. And we'll continue this investigation next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from QLP 100.1 FM, voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt management.